When I went out to dinner last night, I had every intention of eating a nutritious, low-calorie meal and staying away from the junk. And I have to say, it started out pretty well. I had a salad, a delicious chicken dish, some vegetables. But that bread, a whole basket of it, was sitting there on the table. I ignored it for a while, but then it started calling me. I kept telling myself I'd have just one piece, but then I had a second and a third, and well, I ate everything in that basket. And when the waitress asked if I wanted dessert, I could hear myself saying in my own mind, "Don't do it. You don't need it. You're going to eat healthy tonight." But I heard my voice saying, "Yes, please. Some of the strawberry cheesecake." Sound familiar? For many of you, I suspect it does. Millions of people are trying to watch their weight, and it sometimes works, but then there's the basket of bread or the cheesecake or whatever. Or maybe for you it's not eating that's a problem, but maybe making yourself exercise regularly. You want to get in shape, you really do, but you can't keep it up. Or maybe you're trying to control your drinking or to stop smoking or to not procrastinate so badly. Or maybe you have a problem spending too much money, or worrying too much, or losing your temper. And as hard as you try, you can't stop yourself. Most of us have things that we'd like to change about ourselves, but it's a struggle. And that's a really odd thing. We often don't seem to be able to control our own bodies. I mean, whose body is it anyway? The one that's reaching for the cookie, or the cigarette, or the credit card? Whose body is it that can't get to the gym or lies awake at night worrying too much? It's obviously yours, but you often don't have much control over it. Well, why not? Why can't we always make ourselves do what we should and not do what we shouldn't? That's an extremely puzzling feature of human behavior. But it's not just a puzzling question, it's an important one as well. Because failures of self-control contribute to a great deal of human misery. And you know that's the case if you can't control your eating or exercising or smoking as you'd like. Not only that, people's inability to control their own behavior underlies many serious social problems. Think of all the violence in society. Most violence happens because people can't control their impulses. Most people don't really want to abuse their children or their romantic partners or fly into a violent rage, but often they don't seem able to help it. And along the same lines, a good deal of crime reflects a lack of self-control. Granted, sometimes people carefully and purposefully plan crimes in advance, but often they're just impulsive crimes of opportunity that the person couldn't resist, even while knowing how stupid it was. So let's take a look at what researchers have learned about self-control, and maybe more importantly, what they've learned about failures of self-control. We don't have a complete picture of exactly how self-control works, but we do know a lot about what's involved from the thousands of research studies that have been conducted. So what do we know? First, we know that problems with self-control almost always involve a conflict between two competing goals or motives, what psychologists call a dual motive conflict. I want to watch my weight, but I'm also motivated to enjoy the bread and cheesecake. You want to stop smoking, but you also want a cigarette. A person wants to be a faithful spouse, but there's a tempting sexual opportunity at hand. The college student wants to study for the test tomorrow, but he also wants to go out and have fun with his friends. In most instances in which people don't control their behavior successfully, the person is in this sort of dual motive conflict, being drawn in different directions by competing desires. And when this happens, the goals that are in conflict often differ in how abstract and distant versus concrete and immediate they are. My goal to be healthy or to lose weight is a bit abstract and remote. It's not really going to be achieved this evening by eating healthily. But my goal to enjoy a delicious dinner is concrete and immediate. I can achieve that goal right now by diving into the bread and ordering the cheesecake. And concrete and immediate goals are more compelling. They're more powerful than abstract and distant goals. In the moment that a person faces a dual motive conflict, those abstract, distant goals usually don't feel as strong, even though they're often more important. To make matters worse, distant goals don't seem worth as much as immediate goals. Or to say it differently, the consequences of a person's actions seem less important the further the consequences are in the future. Researchers call this effect temporal discounting. People discount outcomes that are further away in the future. Imagine, for example, that I give you a choice. I'll give you $900 right now, or I'll give you $1,000 6 months from now. Guaranteed. It's your choice. $900 now, $1,000 6 months from now. Some of you are thinking that maybe you ought to take the $900 now. What that means is that the value of $1,000 is going down the longer you have to wait for it. If you have to wait 6 months, $1,000 may seem worth less than $900. A future reward doesn't seem as valuable as an immediate one. So let's think about the effects of temporal discounting on self-control. Our important goals often involve things that will happen in the future. I'm not going to lose a noticeable amount of weight today by passing on the bread and cheesecake or exercising this afternoon. Losing weight might take months or years. And the same applies with negative outcomes. Punishments don't seem as bad when they're in the distant future as when they're going to happen very soon. So distant punishments don't deter us as much from doing bad things as immediate punishments do. The student who doesn't study enough for tomorrow's test so he can go to a party tonight might reconsider if he would receive a bad grade tonight rather than a few days from now. So we have two things working against us when we face these dual motive conflicts. Abstract rewards are not as compelling as concrete rewards, and consequences that we'll receive in the future seem to be worth less to us than immediate consequences. And unfortunately, the goal that we're often working for example, to lose weight or to be healthy or to improve our grades, is both more abstract and more distant than the goal to enjoy tempting behaviors right now. In light of these features of dual motive conflicts, successful self-control often involves finding some way to promote our abstract and distant goals even in the face of immediate and concrete competing goals. People must do extra work in their own mind to make the important abstract distant goal more immediate and specific so that it can compete successfully with the specific and immediate temptation. One recommendation that's sometimes given is to tell other people about your long-term goal. So you tell other people that you're trying to eat less or exercise more or stop smoking or control your temper or whatever. Part of the reason that this recommendation can help with self-control is that it provides a new immediate consequence that supports the long-term goal. If I had told you before you and I went to dinner last night that I was cutting back on eating, particularly bread and desserts, I would have looked like an idiot if I dug into a basket of bread and a piece of cheesecake. And maybe the threat of looking ridiculous to you would have deterred my bad behavior, because now there's an immediate consequence. That tactic can certainly help. But we have to be aware that when we make a resolution to ourselves or to other people, we usually do so in a moment of cool rationality, when we are not under the spell of the temptation. So standing right here, right now, I may honestly believe that I can resist the next basket of bread that I encounter at dinner. It seems so easy right now. But what I'm forgetting is that at this moment, my goal to eat less is not engaged in a battle with an urge to eat bread. There isn't any bread here. Resisting temptation sometimes seems quite easy when the temptation isn't present. But when the temptation actually appears, the person loses control. Research shows that the mere presence of a temptation activates urges or motives to indulge in the undesired behavior. So, for example, for people who are dieting, food cues, such as seeing food or even smelling food, cause them to report greater hunger and a greater desire to eat. Right now, I don't have any desire for bread or cheesecake. But if somebody started serving cheesecake in a little while, I'd suddenly want some. Likewise, smokers who are abstaining from smoking often do just fine until they smell cigarette smoke. Then they start thinking positive thoughts about cigarettes. People are often surprised when their strong intentions to control themselves suddenly go out the window when temptations arise. But that's because their intention was made when those temptations weren't present. People who are really successful at self-control seem to know this. They plan ahead to avoid strong temptations because they know that they might not be able to resist the urge after it arises. So, if a woman knows that she can't drive by the donut shop without stopping in, she can avoid the temptation by not getting anywhere close to fresh, hot donuts. In some ways, that might seem a bit pathetic. Do I mean that I sometimes have so little control over myself that I need to stay out of the sight and the smell of donuts? Well, yes, just maybe. Many temptations arise only in the presence of the desired stimulus. Many children realize this at an early age. Research on how children resist temptation shows that even by age 4, some children have developed useful self-control strategies. In one series of studies, psychologist Walter Michel and his colleagues showed children a tray of goodies, such as marshmallows, cookies, pretzel sticks, and they asked each child which one of these things they liked the most. Then the researcher made each child an offer. They could either eat one treat right away, or if they waited for a few minutes, they could have two treats. Then the child was left alone for 20 minutes with the marshmallow or the cookie or the pretzel sitting right in front of them. They knew that they could eat it at any time if they wanted to, but then, of course, they wouldn't get a second one. The children showed a great deal of variability in how they dealt with this temptation. Some kids gobbled up the treat immediately. Some waited a little while and then gave in. And some held out for the whole 20 minutes and got two treats. And it was informative how the children who resisted the treat managed to do so. In many cases, they actually covered up their eyes or they turned their chairs around so they couldn't see the goodies. Just like the woman who avoids driving past the donut store, they knew that when it comes to temptations, out of sight is sometimes out of mind. So the implication is clear. The first line of defense in resisting temptations is to avoid being exposed to them. Sometimes that's not possible, but when you can just stay away from a temptation, do it. Research also tells us that once people are being tempted, they aren't likely to control themselves unless they are thinking consciously about their goals at the time. Imagine a man who wants to stop chewing his fingernails. As long as he's thinking about not chewing his nails, he'll probably be okay. But if he gets distracted and stops thinking about his goal, he might nibble them away without even realizing it. Whatever your goals and values are, you don't just pursue them automatically unless you have developed very strong habits. Often you must be consciously thinking about those goals or values in order to act consistently with them. Research shows that people are more likely to lose self-control when they're not thinking about their goals and intentions. So when people have a goal that they want to protect from self-control failure, they need to keep that goal in mind. Perhaps you're one of those people who put reminders of important goals all around, on your refrigerator or your bathroom mirror. Of course, even that doesn't always help. People sometimes engage in undesired behaviors, even while they're telling themselves that they shouldn't be doing it. These are called acratic actions, which comes from a Greek word that means a failure of will or a failure of self-control. Acratic actions are really interesting because they show that, although keeping one's goal in mind is necessary for self-control, it isn't always sufficient. Last night, I told myself that I shouldn't order the cheesecake at precisely the moment that I was ordering it. Another reason that we fail at self-control is that our primary goals change. As I said, we are often balancing competing goals in a dual motive conflict. If the relative importance or salience of the goals change, our actions may change. Imagine a woman who decides to donate blood for the first time. It's a good thing to do. Her friends donate blood, and although she's a bit afraid of needles, she decides to go to the blood center to give blood. So her goal to donate blood is strong enough to get her in the car and to the donation center. But then when she gets there and she sees the needles and the bags of blood, she turns around and walks out. She just can't go through with it. But why? Because her primary goal changed. Sitting at home, her primary goal was to donate blood. But then seeing all of those needles and bags of blood, her goal changed. Now she was focused on avoiding having a needle stuck in her vein. In cases such as this, it might not be accurate to say that the woman didn't successfully exercise self-control. Because in fact, the woman behaved consistently with her primary goal throughout the whole process. It's just that her primary goal changed from donating blood to not being stuck with a big needle. When people fail at self-control with respect to one goal, they may be very successful with respect to the competing goal. I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I just don't have enough energy to carry through on some goal that I have. I know what I should do, my intentions are good, but I can't muster up enough self-control strength to carry through with what I want to do. Over the past 15 years or so, psychological researchers have become very interested in this previously unexamined aspect of self-control. The idea is that it takes a certain amount of psychological energy to make ourselves do what we should and to not do what we shouldn't. And sometimes we just don't seem to have enough of whatever that energy is. In everyday language, we might say that the person doesn't have enough willpower. Researchers who study this topic call this energy self-control strength, or sometimes they call it self-regulatory resources. Researchers have had trouble identifying precisely what self-control strength or willpower is, so they have resorted to metaphors. Some researchers think of it as operating something like a muscle. To lift something heavy, your muscles have to be strong enough. And to exert self-control requires that your will is strong enough, that you have enough self-control strength. Other people think of it as something like a battery. And just as a battery can become too weak to power a flashlight or your cell phone, your self-control battery can be too weak to control your impulses and behavior. Now, of course, self-control strength is not really a muscle. It's not really a battery. And in fact, we aren't quite sure what it is. And we aren't quite sure what processes in the brain underlie willpower. But we do know a little bit about how it works. Clearly, people sometimes feel that they don't have enough self-control strength to do something. They say things like, "I just couldn't make myself get out of bed this morning." Or they say, "I couldn't stop myself from eating the whole package of cookies." Or they say, "I just can't make myself exercise." When you think about it, these are really interesting claims. People are saying that they literally can't control their own actions. Are they right? Probably not. Take the person who just couldn't get out of bed this morning. What if we set the person's bedroom on fire? Would the person have enough energy to get out of bed? Or what if we offered the person who just can't make himself exercise, we offer him $50,000 if he exercises 5 days a week for a year? I suspect that he'd suddenly be able to exercise just fine. I know that it genuinely feels like we sometimes can't control ourselves, that we can't resist a temptation or we can't make ourselves do what we should. But it's usually not literally true. But it is certainly true that we sometimes have more of this mysterious self-control energy than at other times. And it does sometimes feel like we lack it altogether, so much so that we can't make ourselves do something. If you've been on a diet, you know that sometimes it's not really all that difficult. You can do fine for a while. I'm reminded of Mark Twain's quip about smoking. Mark Twain said, "Giving up smoking is the easiest thing in the world. I know because I've done it thousands of times." There's some truth here. It is easy to control yourself, sometimes. But then something changes, and you just don't have what it takes to resist the temptation anymore. We feel like we're lacking the essential energy or willpower to do what we should. Social psychologists Roy Baumeister and Mark Moravin pioneered an exceptionally interesting line of research on how self-control strength can become depleted. And over the past 10 years or so, other scientists have conducted dozens of studies on this intriguing phenomenon. Studies have shown that when people must control their behavior on one task, their ability to control themselves on a second task is then weakened. For example, research participants might be asked to watch a video of a woman talking, and they're told to ignore words that appear at the bottom of the screen, which takes self-control. Or participants might be asked to squeeze a hand grip for as long as they can. Again, that requires self-control. Or they might watch a comedian and be told to suppress any signs of amusement that they might feel. And that requires self-control. And then after doing one of these tasks that requires self-control, participants are asked to do a different self-control task, to make themselves focus on a boring task, or to suppress their emotional reactions to upsetting photographs, or to refrain from thinking about a white bear. Consistently, participants who perform one task that requires self-control then do more poorly on a second self-control task than participants who hadn't done an initial self-control task. It's as if the first task used up some of their self-control strength, so they didn't have enough for the second task. Researchers have been careful to eliminate other possible explanations of these effects. For example, studies show that these effects are not due to changes in emotion or to general fatigue. They seem to be due specifically to the depletion of self-control resources. This effect has also been shown with dogs. If you have a dog, you might have trained him to sit and wait while you put his food out. And if your dog's well trained, he might be able to sit there quite a while until you give him the go-ahead to go ahead and eat. But that requires a good deal of self-control. Your dog is in a dual mode of conflict. He's motivated to eat the food, but he's also motivated to please you by waiting until you give the go-ahead. And that raises the possibility that, like human beings, your dog's self-control energy can become depleted. In one interesting study, a researcher took a dog that would obediently sit and wait when his food was being served. And sometimes the researcher made the dog sit and wait a long time. You could see the strain on the dog's face. "Let me eat, let me eat, let me eat." But sometimes the researcher didn't make the dog wait very long. "Go ahead." Then, after having to wait or not wait, and then being able to eat, the dog was given a toy that required persistence to open it up in order to get a treat. And the question was whether the dog would work a shorter time on the persistence task if he had used self-control resources by having to wait to eat. And the answer was yes. Dogs that made themselves wait longer for the food seemed to have less self-control strength, less willpower to work on another task than dogs who didn't have to control themselves earlier. If you monitor yourself closely, you'll notice that your self-control strength waxes and wanes. Sometimes you have a great deal of self-control, but at other times, you don't have enough control to make yourself do something that you should do or to keep yourself from doing something that you shouldn't. For most people, self-control strength decreases as the day goes on. All day long, we have to make ourselves do things that we really don't want to do. Just making themselves go to work is a chore for many people. And then there are unpleasant tasks to do, and we have to control our reactions when other people are frustrating, and we have to control ourselves when other drivers cut us off on the highway. By the end of the day, many people have been engaging in a lot of self-control for many hours, sometimes to the point that their self-control strength is pretty low. So ask yourself, when do you tend to find yourself not managing your own behaviors and emotions successfully? When are you most likely to overeat or lose your temper or procrastinate or succumb to various temptations? For most of us, the likelihood of lapses in self-control increases as the day wears on, because we've already used up a lot of our self-regulatory resources during the day. People are much better at self-control earlier in the day. And again, this is not just a matter of physical fatigue. It's the depletion of self-control strength. As I mentioned, we don't have a very good understanding of how self-control strength works. What's going on in the brain that provides the energy that we need to follow through on our goals and our intentions? And what happens to drain that energy so that we can't always control ourselves as we'd like? At present, the physiological processes that underlie self-control and the depletion of self-control remain a mystery. So self-control is difficult. Each time we want to make ourselves do something that we don't want to do, or try to resist the temptation to do something that we shouldn't do, we are up against many obstacles that interfere with successful self-control. And as you know, we often fail. But like it or not, we are not designed to be paragons of self-control. So we just have to accept the fact that we have to work extra hard when we find ourselves pulled in competing directions by different desires.